Ayes. The Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session.
Thanks. Please be seated. Okay. Welcome to the Arizona Court of Appeals. Today we are here in what we call an order to show cause hearing in the matter Nastaran Barari, and please correct me when you come up if I misstate your name, ma'am. Nastaran Barari versus Kemi D. Burgess. We have the proceedings on YouTube, both live and recorded, so please, ma'am, when you get up, please state your name. We know you represent yourself. The matter is 1 CACV 25-0815. And when you approach the podium, we're going to actually swear you in, because your statements will also be taken under oath as evidence to the extent we need to have any evidence with regard to the hearing. So, ma'am, thank you for coming down to see us today, and please step up when you're ready. And Judge Furuya, would you mind administering the oath?
Certainly. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. And you are, ma'am, Nastaran Barari?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And you filed the opening brief in this case, the under our case number 25-0815?
Yes, I did, in pro se capacity.
Okay. And you did receive our order dated 4/30/26, setting this hearing?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And in response to that, you also submitted an appellant's explanation reorder to show cause, and that was filed on... Actually, when was that filed?
Feel free to consult your notes, ma'am. Thank you.
I think it was the beginning of May. 4th of May, does that sound right?
That is correct.
Okay. And did you write this, or did someone else write it for you?
No, I did write that myself, and it was based on history of drafts and research that I had already prepared for the appeal brief that I was able to quickly identify where I made the mistakes.
Okay. One of my concerns with this response is that it doesn't answer all of our questions.
Correct.
Okay, so I would like you to answer those questions.
Sure. Yes, I will.
Okay, so your response says that you used various research tools, is what it says. Our question to you was, did you use generative AI?
I did not use generative AI in the capacity of, for example, looking for cases.
Okay, so that's not my question. My question is, did you use generative AI?
I used something to capacity of Copilot that is on Microsoft for editing purposes of, for example, grammatic errors, etc.
Okay.
That is, I guess it's still generative AI because it does it.
So Copilot is all you used?
Copilot is all I used.
And you're saying you used it to edit, not to research or write?
No, my research is primarily based on Westlaw from the law library at the court, lower court, and then based on what I found in Westlaw in terms of cases that I thought mattered to my brief. I came to this law library, to the Court of Appeals law library, and I cross-checked it with the briefs that were filed to see if there is a resemblance of issues with what I'm filing as issues, to see which cases I should then use to cite in my case.
So we didn't used to have generative AI matters come before us, and now it seems like every month we have a hearing like this because the world's changing real fast.
Yes.
And one of the things in our notes that we noted was that there seems to be at least one non-existent case, and that's what makes us kind of wonder, hey, where'd that come from? Because Westlaw doesn't generate non-existent cases, and we have this one Morrison versus Mandel, 216 Arizona 289 that you cite. Are you sure you got that from Westlaw and not somewhere else?
No, that was, how to say it bluntly, that was an unintelligent mistake in copying names over from different documents. So, for example, I had created an alphabetically ordered list of the cases that I was going to utilize in Excel. I found through, once I received your letter of an order to come and show cause, I was truly breaking my head about this case, and I was sure that the case existed. And then I searched through my phone, through my drives to see how did I come to this case if the court says it doesn't exist. Then I found out by searching just one by one, for example, Morrison. Then I got the Morrison v. Morrison, Dressler v. Morrison, but it didn't come with Mandel. Then I looked up on Mandel. Finally, I found that I made a mistake in naming. So I mixed up two different names in one. And then I further searched to find out where did I get those issue numbers, page numbers, and years
so
from.
So you're saying then you had Morrison v. Morrison and another case. What's the case?
Dressler v. Morrison.
Dressler
so
v.
those
Morrison.
Were all in my list.
Okay. And then where's the Mandel name come from?
The Mandel is from In Re the Marriage of Morris v. Mandel.
Morris v. Mandel. And so one of those two cases would stand for the proposition that you're citing Morrison v. Mandel for.
Well, Morris v. Mandel, I had used it in a previous motion, and that's why it was stuck in my head. And it was in matter of the child custody, and I just could not figure out how it landed in argument one, which is about due process, whereas Dressler v. Morrison is due process. So then I looked back at my drafts. I had about 27 different drafts that I had created before I created the final draft, because I had to constantly condense my arguments from 9 to 6 to make sure that I meet the word count limitations. And then I found that I just copied, because I also created the table of authorities manually. I just wrote something that was a mixture of different things. And then I went, and I actually used generative AI to look for me, where did I find this issue number, page number, and the year, because I could not find the similarities in my drive where I had all the different cases saved. There was no match. So I'm not even sure how I got that issue number. To be honest, as a pro se, I worked on this brief every day till nighttime after my work hours. And so I worked till late, and I think that was a mistake to do, because I just made very unintelligent errors in that case. And I spent too much time on the research and cutting down, rather than spending time on the final editing and reviewing to make sure that what I'm putting in, what I have copy-pasted out of different documents, is actually making sense, including the fact that Chrissy v. ADES was never supposed to be my case. I had copied that section from someone else's brief, put into Google search, which I found in my search history, to find out what it exactly says.
You copied that section from someone else's brief.
So another parent who has an appeal filed, she was using that section. And I thought, does it make sense for my brief to refer to this citation? So I had put it into Google search to find out what is it exactly based on. And it did not meet the criteria of my case, and that area, that specifically about circulation error. I think, to be honest, and looking at how many times this happened during the drafting, is that when I copied and pasted things from one document to another, that piece was still in the copy status, and I accidentally put it in my case after referencing a different case. And so that piece about Chrissy v. ADES just erroneously placed in my brief without me wanting it, and when I edited it, I didn't even consider it, that was not supposed to be there.
Something, put something in your brief that you didn't want in there?
Yes, and so during the final read-through, because I kept reading myself through the brief numerous times, I did not realize that what I had there as a piece was not ever supposed to be in my brief, because it did not make sense in regard to what I was arguing. It was essentially copied, pasted into Google to see what the case stand for. Well, it did not meet the criteria for my brief, but when I was trying to copy something else, that was still on the I guess it's called clipboard, what they call it, and that was pasted in there, and I never paid attention to it and left it there. Even after I reviewed it, I still did not realize that I had left something there that did not make sense.
So you're saying you worked like all these hours and you worked, you know, late at night on this. So how is it that you have all these mismatches between what the case says and what you say the case says? Because it sounds like you, I'll put it as a question, did you go back and read every case in your final draft to say this case really says what I'm claiming it says? Did you do that?
Yes, that's what I did. So first I looked up cases, for example, in the lower court law library. I went on the Westlaw, and I looked for cases regarding child custody, due process, etc., the arguments that I was going to make. And then looking first at the statute, it would give me a list of where the certain notes were made. I forgot what the section is called, essentially notations in appellate decisions. So I would go through those cases. I would save those case responses, so the appeals court responses, I would save them. I would read through them. If I found there was some sort of similarity to what I was going to argue, I came to this law library and I would search the cases in on the computers, read through the brief to see what their argument was, and if the argument was somewhat matching my argument, in order for me to use those citations.
But like, sorry, go ahead,
Judge. No, please go ahead.
Well, you have like Cook versus Lasnegard.
Yes.
You said at page 46 of your brief, judges must be reassigned if their conduct creates the appearance of partiality. And then you cite it to paragraph 12 of Cook versus Lasnegard. But the cited paragraph, your paragraph 12, talks about child support arguments. And although the case mentions judicial bias, it doesn't say what you say the case says. And it does that in a different paragraph. So did you look at Cook versus Lasnegard?
Yes, I did. And then what I also mentioned.
So did you see that it doesn't say what you claimed it said, or did you not notice?
No, I did notice what the claim was about. Where I have, for example, case citations stacked, I was under the assumption that if there is a reference made to a certain type of theme, I can use that case to cite it, but I was not, after this letter was sent to me, I became aware that I must cite exactly what the case say to exactly what I'm saying. So unlike, for example, I was a political science student, I would read five books and I would generate, for example, information from the five books and put out a theory and then cite the different authors that had referenced that theory, but I noticed that in law that is not the case. So well, I must be one-on-one and cite exactly what is said.
Well, your brief makes a very specific and very thoughtfully phrased attribution. Judges must be reassigned if their conduct creates the appearance of partiality. That's a very specific attribution. You attribute it to a correctly cited case. You put it in paragraph 12. But paragraph 12 just doesn't say that. So it seems candidly like it comes from somewhere else. It doesn't seem like an accident, but it's just how it looks.
The paragraph is not correct?
Well, the case, like going back to your prior answer, you said, well, I thought if it kind of had a theme, I could use the case to talk about that theme, was what you said. Sort of like, hey, Cook versus Lasnegard sort of generally touches briefly on judicial bias, is what you're saying. I guess my point is you're making a very specific statement about a very specific proposition of law, and you're citing a very specific paragraph that just doesn't say that. So
okay.
It's not really worse if it's generative AI as opposed to just it's not there. It doesn't really matter to us in a way. But it does seem like it comes from another source like generative AI because it's hard to make that many specific attributions to specific paragraphs that aren't there without someone sort of prompting you in the back and saying, hey, ma'am, do it that way. It seems like it's coming from somewhere.
Would the generative AI have provided me with the correct paragraph?
Or the incorrect paragraph,
I think is his point. My point is I think something provided you with an incorrect paragraph. Either you made, you know, lots and lots of accidental good faith mistakes where the case kind of doesn't talk about that or really doesn't talk about that, or some source like generative AI gave you a good hint that way. It's not going to make any difference probably in terms of how we treat it because the rule, you know, you can't make stuff up whether generative AI does or one of us does or you do. People aren't supposed to make stuff up. That's
yes,
all.
That is correct.
So it doesn't make a lot of difference. We're just interested in how it happens.
And to elaborate on or build on Judge Jacobs' point, I don't care if you use generative AI. Mm-hmm. What I care is if you don't check your work after generative AI does it for you. Mm-hmm. So if you are able to use ChatGPT or one of those things to draft your brief, wonderful. I hope it saves you lots of time. Mm-hmm. But that time that it saves you should be spent on making sure that you cite us to cases and to the paragraphs of those cases that actually stand for what you claim they cite. And it's maybe even worse. Well, it's no worse or no better. It is just as bad if it's your own work and you're citing us to cases that either don't exist or citing us to cases that exist for propositions that they don't support. So I appreciate you claiming that you didn't use generative AI. But to me, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you have wasted a lot of our time spending tracing down these cases, because what happens is I'll read a brief, whether it's you or someone else, and I'll go, I didn't think that was the law. Mm-hmm. And I end up having to spend my time now looking up, trying to find the case that says it, reading this entire case, because paragraph 12 doesn't say that, so maybe it says it somewhere else in the case, and then I read the entire case, and it's not there, and you've now wasted a lot of my time. There's times three judges here on this case, by being sloppy, whether it's AI or your own work. So what should we do?
Yes, I admit that it was sloppy, and I am truly sorry for that. I wish, to be honest, that I had used more generative AI to spend less time on the drafting of it and more on the research and the editing and the correcting of the end product, because based on your letter, that is when I started using generative AI to find out how did I make these mistakes and how could I have, based on the research and the citations I had in my hand, because I could not figure it out on my own. And then I realized that probably using generative AI would have given me some sort of pushback in certain areas.
Just something you said earlier, is there a chance that maybe you were copying from other people's briefs that they were using generative AI and that's how these mistakes were made?
I used very little from others' briefs than from what was in the content of their brief rather than what the citation.
You were able to find briefs from other pro pers that were helpful to you?
Probably there were only two.
Okay. Well, I would encourage you to be very careful, especially even more so when you're dealing with other people's work.
Yes.
So and these are the types of things, further to what my colleague said, these are the types of things that we normally see when people rely on generative AI. Generative AI regularly hallucinates cases, regularly gives miscitations for cases because it is making it up. And for better or for worse, it's ubiquitously accessible. So it leads us to believe that there's some kind of influence here from that, because there are so many errors here, citation errors. It's not the type of thing that someone who has done careful and consistent research work themselves inside of legitimate sources normally gives us. So bringing that back, and I absolutely agree with Judge Morris and with Judge Jacobs, it doesn't matter if what tool you use, it matters that you use the tool effectively and not waste time.
Yes.
And that you don't lie to the court. You don't misrepresent the law or the facts to the court. There is not one citation to the record in your brief.
They are all incorrect?
No, your record citations.
As opposed to case citations.
So are you familiar with the Arizona Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure, specifically Rule 13?
I probably did not familiarize myself to the full extent to make sure that I cite correctly the way it must.
Did you reference the court's website about advice to those representing themselves?
also to an extent, but not to, I read it in terms of what I must do and what the expectations are, but when it comes to the citation, I think that's where I may have or overlooked very detailed rules.
It's a very basic principle that if you tell us the law says X, you're supposed to put a citation to a case.
Yes.
If you say the court below did X, you cite us to the part of the record where we can say, okay, well, I'll look at the court's minute entry from August 13, 2013, or this piece of evidence that was introduced in court that's part of your record on appeal. If it's not on your record on appeal, it does not exist to me, okay? And if you don't cite to something to support your proposition of this is what happened factually, it does not exist to me. So part of our problem with your brief is that by not citing to any record below, we don't know what happened below. So if you cite to, if you tell us the court did X or my opposing counsel or the opposing party here said something, but you don't cite us to record, that didn't happen.
I'm trying to understand this for a second.
So we are a court of review.
Yes.
Okay. We don't, you'll notice there's no jury. Okay. We don't take new facts and we don't consider new facts. We have to look at what happened in the trial court, which does consider facts, because it's the trial court's job to decide which facts are to be believed and accepted and which ones are not. So that's what happens there.
Yes.
Okay. And that creates a record. Okay. So everything that happens inside of the trial court, that creates a record. Okay. So if you have a problem with that, you bring it to a court of review. That's what we do. But we can only review what happened inside of that court. You can't come here and say, oh, the court, I have all this other stuff that I didn't give the court, and I want you to look at it. That doesn't happen. And Arizona Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 13 says very clearly that when you give us your argument, you have to be citing where in the record those facts come from. You can't just say, This is what truth is, right? This is what happened. You have to say, here's what happened, and this is the document that comes out of the record where it happened. Because we can't, we have as many as like 3,000 new cases every year. We can't go through every case with a fine-tooth comb when there's no record cites. So there are, and that isn't a question here, that's a statement. There are no record cites in your brief. It's 70 pages long, and there's no record cites. There's all kinds of miscitations to cases, and there's a hallucinated case. So you have legal citation errors. You have no record cites. To circle back in that context to Judge Morris's question, what should we do?
Okay, now I understand. So I was supposed to cite back to the decision of the lower court based on which I'm essentially making the argument within each distinct argument, and that is where I failed to provide exact direction to that.
Let me be specific. If you're doing something like this, the things you would be citing as you've made your argument would be the decree, because you refer to it, has a specific number. If you look at the docket of your case, we go by index of record number, whatever, like 10 or 50 or 100, it has a number. You'd say decree, index of record 100 or whatever the number is. There's your motion to modify the decree. There's the court's minute entry about that. They all have numbers. And then any response to your motion to modify. That's probably most of the universe of what you need to be citing. But you need to be citing them by what number they are in the record and then what page of them that you're citing. And that's part of what Judge Faria and Judge Morris are trying to help you understand. Our Rule 13 says you have to stick those in. So we have the law citations and then the fact citations. Those are two kind of separate issues.
Okay. Understood.
So I repeat the question. What do you think we should do?
I hope you are willing to give me a chance to amend this brief so that I provide you a brief that meets the requirements under ARCAP 13, including the citations, correct citations, as well as correct references to the lower court. I spent a lot of time on this appeal months before I even filed it because I was just not very hopeful in the lower court where it would go through, considering the constant rejections. So I had spent a lot of time doing research on the cases and spent a lot of time to write the brief. And I know for sure I made grammatical mistakes. And I know for sure that I made the citation mistakes, but citation mistakes and the case references being more significant, I hope you're willing to give me a chance to provide you with an amended version.
So further to that, your brief ends with a request for relief. Every single item in that request for relief is directed to changing the decree.
Yes.
Can you address that? Is that what you're asking us to do? You're asking us to change the decree?
I was hoping that you would consider remanding those items in the decree, considering that they were decided based on no adequate due process. As I mentioned,
but you didn't appeal the decree.
I filed motions to modify immediately after. There were multiple motions that came after that.
That doesn't answer the question. Did you appeal the decree? Because that's nowhere in the record.
In my initial motion, a broad segment of that decree was appealed through the motion to modify.
That's not an appeal. That's not an appeal to our court. You asked the court below to modify it, and then I think you did it again, but you didn't appeal that first denial, right? And you filed a later motion to modify, which is what you're appealing to us now.
The decree was not initially appealed. Immediately, very shortly after the decree was issued, I filed the motion for contempt, which led into a hearing that led to a lot of decisions kind of getting further out of hand, which for me was I had multiple motions already filed regarding certain aspects that I filed in my decree and then also in the brief. And because the judge was non-responsive, I wasn't sure if submitting an appeal, a motion to set aside, or something as such would even make sense because the judge was just not responding to me. And so that's why I decided to go straight to the Court of Appeal. I had tried. I had tried with Judge Welty. I had tried with Judge Fisk. And they were all supporting the same.
I think the question that Judge Faria and I are trying to get to is, like he said, we're a court of review. We only get to review decisions that were appealed. The decree was not appealed. Your motion to set aside or to modify, one of your motions to modify, I think, was ultimately appealed. How do we then reverse the decree or rewrite the decree, as you're asking us to do, when all we can deal with is the actual motion that was appealed?
There were two significant portions that were appealed through motions. One of them was the child custody matter based on evidence of domestic violence. And the other one was...
All that stuff, I'm looking at the transcript from the hearing on your petition to enforce and modify. Actually, in the court's decision, this is his September 2nd decision. This is Judge Knapp's September 2nd decision, or September 3rd decision. And it says, the court finds that the testimony and evidence provided on 8-26-25, that's the hearing on this, on your petition to modify, that's the one that you appealed. Okay, so that's the one that has a notice of appeal. It says is insufficient to show that either has committed an act of domestic violence since March of 2025, which is when the decree was entered. Okay, mother obtained a May 2025 order of protection, and he gives a case number, but father hasn't requested a contested hearing under the rules of protection procedure. So, and then in the actual hearing at that date in August, He says, you said, quote, I have acquired or I have obtained a new order of protection against him, referring to your ex, that I was able to provide with evidence that domestic violence is ongoing. And then the court responds, I hear what you're saying, but I already addressed this in the decree. I found that the evidence was insufficient to show that either of you had engaged in acts of domestic violence. I went back and found that application. That application only references, sorry, that's not the application. This is the application. It only references items from 2024 at the earliest. That's all prior to the issuance of the decree. So here I have a judge saying, we've already dealt with this. I knew about it. I considered it. I dealt with it inside of the decree. And then you say, but I have a new order of protection. And this order of protection is from that caseload, so we can take judicial notice of this. And it says May 2025. So this is the one that you were referencing. But then as backup for it, it says, hey, based on what happened back in 2023 through 2024, I want an order of protection. And you get this order. So this order is issued.
But your own allegations all related to events that occurred before 2025.
Before the decree.
Before the decree.
The decree was signed in early March. In the court, I was in the court of order protection for a trial on disputing his order protection in April of 2025, where evidence was provided, and the result of that trial was that there is a significant domestic violence committed and likely to be committed. That
this
is a different one. So first in April, I had a hearing in Commissioner Morton's courtroom, based on which she confirmed or affirmed that the order of protection against me was false. However, I was able to provide evidence to show that there was domestic violence committed and ongoing. In fact, in the courtroom, there was domestic violence happening in Judge Morton's courtroom, which I took to Commissioner Fruchtman, and I explained to her, and I made a mistake in the dating. I said 2024, but it must be April 2025, because that's when the hearing occurred, and that's where the ongoing domestic violence occurred, outside of the fact that there were other police records.
Okay. Yes. You're talking about things that are not in the record. You're saying, oh, I must have done this, I must have done that. What I see is a record, and it says everything is based off of what happened before the decree was entered.
The decree
that is what the record says. We can't change the record.
The decree did not consider anything regarding domestic violence and the decision.
No, it said that there is no domestic violence. It specifically made a finding that there was no domestic violence.
Correct. That's what it said. And that's what
That is considering domestic violence. It's saying, I have considered the allegations of domestic violence and there is no domestic violence. That's what the decree says.
Correct. And then in
April, so you agree with that?
Yes. That happened during that time, during the trial.
So your appeal is asking us to say the court was wrong in saying that there was no domestic violence. That's how I'm reading your brief. Is that your argument?
No. When I motioned the court after the decree and I provided evidence that the court findings that there is no domestic evidence is rebutted by the order protection court, who affirmed that there is domestic violence. That's why I brought it before the court in May, and then it ended up in August before the court in a hearing. That was what I was arguing in the court in August. It was not specifically what the decree said, because the decree did not have that decision yet. The decision from Order Protection Court came after the decree was issued. And I was arguing that because the court went off of, you have an order of protection, he has one against you, so I'm just assuming there's no domestic violence happening,
which is what the statute says. If there's domestic violence on both sides, meaning if there's criminal harassment,
yes,
on both sides, then there's no presumption. So
correct,
the statute doesn't apply, which is what the court said.
Correct. And then I prove that now we have evidentiary hearing completed, and now the court affirms that on one side there was domestic violence, on the other side it wasn't. And that's what I brought before the court. because it was ongoing. It was not something that had just happened. It was something that was ongoing, whether it was on physical, emotional, or financial. And
let me stop you there. My point in pointing all of this out is to say that what are you asking us to do? And I'm trying to clarify that because that's not entirely clear from your documents.
Yes.
Okay, so what I'm trying to establish, because what your brief says is, hey, I want you to rewrite the decree. Okay? Is that what you're asking us to do?
No, that is not what I'm asking you to do, to rewrite the decree. I would like for you to review the issues and find where due process was lacking, where evidence was clear.
To review the decree, that's what you're asking us to do. Review the decree and what happened during the decree.
The decree and everything that happened after, based on which I filed for this appeal. So there was a decree, and then there were follow-ups to the decree that did not correct the decree. And there was actually recently another motion that you collected the motions about up to March 31st, which was an aggravated domestic violence with evidence, and the Judge Knapp would still not make changes despite the evidence, whether it was police report evidencing and or forensic reports, medical reports, as well as video recordings of the incident. So what I'm asking is if that you would please consider that there are issues that are occurring, and that understanding that his initial decision was based on two standing orders of protections, for example, against each other, making the decision that then there is none. However, after that it changed and I immediately brought it before him. He did not give me an evidentiary hearing until the opposing party filed a petition to enforce, and that's the only time why we were given a hearing. Then I brought up my issues to the court, which were filed in multiple motions before the petition to enforce was filed, including the court's intervention in issuing passports for my children so that they can see their family in Europe, as well as considering that the evidence in the order of protection court changes the decision on whether domestic violence exists or not.
My question, last question, or only question I have is, okay, I think I understand a little better your request from your brief. In response to our order to show cause, what should we do?
I hope, again, if you are willing to allow me to make amendments.
My mind is you need to be punished in some way for your errors. Not saying that that's my decision, but what would be an appropriate sanction, was what we call them in court, for your failures to properly cite the record, your failures to properly cite cases, and your citation to at least one inaccurate case that does not exist?
Yes.
What's an appropriate sanction?
First of all, I hope you accept from me that I did not hallucinate that case.
Whether we let you file a new brief is a different issue. The question is, what do we do to discourage you and others who may be like you from doing this in the future?
Hiring an attorney to write a brief is very expensive, so I'm not sure if I would want to suggest that do not do this as a pro se, because it's very complicated.
We welcome pro ses, and we think it's important that people
That is not a punishment the court would contemplate to prevent you from filing as yourself. A punishment could include limiting the length of your submission, saying we would strike any submission that didn't comply with the rules that we tried to help explain to you today. It could mean doing all those things and fining you $500 or $1,000. It could be anything like that.
I would be agreeing that that is an appropriate punishment, to say that I should not be exceeding a certain limit and correct where I made mistakes and limit my facts and arguments to what is necessary, and not be given more room to elaborate, if anything. And financially, I'm not in a position to pay fines, but I am not going to make that decision for you if you must.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time, ma'am. We'll take what you've told us today under consideration, and we will issue an order in response.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you. And I'm sorry again for your mistakes.
Thank you for saying so, ma'am. We stand in recess.
Thank you.